This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Goddess's Chariot, Myths and Folklore of the Moon.
So, I would like to just say that I suggested this episode last week, but in a very typical way of not really explaining myself very well, I just said to Jules, let's talk about the moon!
And Jules's brain, which is not getting any younger, went, bleh!
Like,
require more input.
what about the moon? But then in the end we did another Dissecting Dragons episode anyway, and we said, okay, we'll talk about the moon another time. And then this week Jules messages me saying, let's talk about the moon, and my brain went, what? Like, just in general.
See, I assumed you'd be kind of, like, fine with it because you've had an entire week to think about it.
Well, yes, that's the thing, but just, my brain was not functioning on all cylinders. And even better yet was when Jules sent me the schedule via email, her subject, with no capitals, simply said, the moon. And it was so innocuous. I just half expected to open it just saying, like, we need to talk about the moon. I have some concerns.
This is what happens when you're doing two or three things at the same time. You miss some of the fine details.
Exactly. So, yes.
Don't multitask, people. It's a lie.
Yeah. So the reason why I first suggested we do an episode about the moon is that, obviously, very recently, we had a super blue moon, full moon, and a blood moon all on the same night, which sounds like there were three different moons in the sky. There wasn't. It was all the same moon.
The moon was multitasking that night.
It was very much multitasking that night, which is probably why I didn't get to see a lot of it, because there was a lot of cloud cover. But it was a rather fantastic phenomenon. And as I was looking up at it, as it pierced through the misty clouds, and it was just beautiful, I kept thinking about how it resonated within me and how there's just something so ancient about it. I mean, not even sort of geologically, I know the moon is pretty old. I just meant that there's that feeling within us, this relationship between people and the moon. And I suddenly thought, gosh, I want to sit and talk to Jules about this. And thus here we are.
So before we get on to the more esoteric and mysterious facts, and some of the really weird stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
Just a little bit about the moon. Just general knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have probably absorbed most of this. But when the Earth started out, it didn't actually have a natural satellite. It didn't have a moon. The moon came along slightly later. Mm. The moon was supposed to have formed around 4.5 billion years ago. Which seems like a really long time, but in terms of the universe is actually kind of a blink of an eye.
Mm-hmm.
That was 60 million years after the formation of the solar system, which is when the proto-Earth would have been sort of where it is now, mm-hmm. hopefully.
Yeah.
Bearing in mind that obviously we are drilling as a solar system through the universe, so there's that scary thought for you as
Hooray!
Well. There's several theories about how the moon was formed and where it came from. One is obviously that, you know, the Earth's gravitational pull actually sort of attracted a passing large celestial body. I mean, the moon's quite big.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a small rock.
No.
And sort of attracted it, and it got caught in the gravitational pull of the Earth, and that's how we end up with a natural satellite. And
mm-hmm.
honestly, that theory's kind of bollocks. It just doesn't fit the physics.
Yeah.
There are other theories as well, but the most plausible one is that the moon was formed after a super impact of a Mars-sized body you know, celestial body, not just a random body, random body flung through the universe. No, a celestial body known as Theia,
mm-hmm.
and it impacted with the proto-Earth. This is like way, way, way before the dinosaurs or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Nothing was alive on Earth. We were all just kind of stardust. And the impact blasted material into the Earth's orbit, which accreted and formed the Moon. And then obviously the Moon then formed a relatively stable orbit around the Earth.
Yes. Of course, there are other theories as well, which are less based in science. One of them, my favourite, is the Moon is an egg. Yeah. What do you think of that one, Jules?
I would have to see you working. Show me the math, okay?
Listen, it's an egg and it's about to crack, okay?
It's an egg, right, yes, okay. And the Nazis had a secret base there during World War II.
You can't prove they didn't.
Okay, we're not going to go down. Sorry, that actually gave me like an ice headache. This is not good. The maths doesn't lie. Okay. The moon.
Good.
The moon is the Earth's only natural satellite. So obviously we have other things up there orbiting the Earth, and some of them are supposed to be there and some of them aren't. But the only one that, you know, we didn't put there is the moon. And the moon is in synchronous rotation with the Earth. So when we look at the moon, we're seeing the same side all the time.
Mm.
So even as it goes through the phases, etc., where the light from the sun... Everybody knows that the moon doesn't generate its own light, right? They do know that it's sort of reflected light from the sun, and when the reason you get moon phases is because parts of the Earth get in the way.
It's glow-in-the-dark.
Okay, yeah, like the stars on the ceiling.
Yep.
Yeah, okay. Okay, if you want flights of fancy and speculation, go with Madeline's theories. If you want something that's a little bit more based in facts, then you might like to check out mine.
Let me just put forward, I don't believe any of these things that I'm saying. I'm just repeating some of the things that I've seen, which I find amusing. So before anyone thinks that I'm some sort of crackpot, I'm not. I'm just putting forward the other side of the argument. To create an equal debate. To create an equal debate.
You see, that's not an argument. That's just some sort of random fact. That you can't argue it because we're not talking the same language.
And yet.
That's one of those ones where, you know, you don't know, not you personally, but you don't know anything. So you throw in a random sort of, you can't prove it isn't fact to somebody who actually genuinely does have a qualification in science. And there's so much wrong with what you've just said. They genuinely don't know where to start to unpack it. Because it is that fucking ludicrous and nobody should believe it. It's like it's people saying the Earth is flat.
Oh God, yes. So.
Yes. Okay. Obviously, the moon also affects tides and, you know, day length when it comes to seasons. It's all tied up with that as well.
Mm. Oh, I do know the fact that the moon is actually moving away from us by about, what is it, like 3 centimetres a year?
Yeah, that's why when you have a solar eclipse, the moon, sort of, obviously the sun's much, much further away, otherwise we'd all be dead.
Yeah.
Because it's way too hot. But it appears to be the same size as the sun, and gradually, when you get an eclipse, you're seeing more and more of the sun around the moon when there's a total solar eclipse. Because, as Madeline says, the moon is gradually moving away. It doesn't want to be in this relationship anymore.
And I can understand why.
The moon itself is obviously is actually made of quite dark rock.
Mm.
So it's about the same sort of reflective ability as tarmac. But, you know, when you compare that to actually the black void of space and the fact that the sun is obviously very, very bright and very hot, the moon is incredibly bright by comparison to the rest of it. And there's some interesting things about the name, the moon. It's, you know, we think we get the word month from the moon.
Yeah.
From the same sort of root word as moon. But the thing is, we don't know which one came first. That's the really interesting thing.
Hmm.
And obviously we used to refer to moons as a measure of time as well. So the name moon comes by way of Germanic Mona, before that Proto-Germanic Menon, and before that Proto-Indo-European mensis, meaning month, possibly related to measure as in a measure of time. So the fact that it goes back that far shows how long we have been using the moon to measure the passage of time, and that's a really interesting point.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it is... It is also very interesting when you contrast it with the sun in many ways, because obviously both of them, as you know, the general stars in the sky and our general sort of solar system have all been used to measure time. Of course, they are also literally responsible for time. Our relationship with the sun is the thing that creates seasons, as well as the thing by which we measure day, time, things along those lines. And the moon, of course, the same thing. It doesn't actually, because the whole cycle of the moon, it's not 30 days, is it? It's about 28 days.
Yes, 28 days.
And of course, in some parts of the world, people do go by the lunar calendar instead of the more modern calendar, which is 30 days, or sometimes 31 days, and occasionally 28 days.
The Julian calendar,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah.
It's worth adding also that until relatively recently, and by recently I mean sort of within the last 400 years, which I appreciate for Americans is not that recent, but over here in the UK, that is comparatively recent. We were on a different calendar, so you could be in the middle of October in Britain and go over to France and it was already almost Christmas.
Yeah.
Because they were using a completely different calendar to us.
Yes. Ah, gosh. Time is a strange thing. But back to the moon.
It's as Madeline was saying at the beginning, where the moon has a deep personal resonance for her. Just because it's kind of there. I think that's fair to say that it has that for humankind as a whole. In many ways, maybe not for each individual, but certainly since we started keeping account of things like time, and we started thinking about planning and storing food for the future, since we lived in caves, the moon and this passage of the seasons became incredibly important. It's not really surprising that they and the sun kind of venerated in their own right.
I agree. And there's also the fact that it's just, without the context of knowing what it was, you imagine what it would be like years and years and years and years ago to just look up, have no context for what this thing is, to have no real context for what stars are or what the sun is, but just to know that every single night it's there, and yet that it seems to have this metamorphosis which is reliable every time. I mean, it would have just been fantastic, really. And it's no wonder to me that at the heart of most mythologies, there is a particular relationship, usually between the moon and the sun. And, I mean, you just have to look at Greek and Norse mythology, their brother and sister.
Yeah, obviously depending on which part of Greek mythology you're going
to. Yes, this is true, yeah. But, you have this kind of this relationship, but also this idea of the two chasing one another. And also because of that, the two being sort of juxtaposed with one another. And therefore the moon has come to represent women a lot of the time in certain areas. And the sun represents sort of, and I say women, I mean the feminine qualities. And the sun represents masculine qualities. And there's just a lot to unpack there. But you can completely understand why. Because it was so mysterious and beautiful and reliable as well. It's one of these sort of things that doesn't change throughout time.
It's the relationship between the moon and women is an interesting and quite complicated one, because if you go back prior to the more patriarchal versions of a lot of myths, classically, the moon was actually associated with male qualities. And the sun, being the thing that allows crops to grow and animals to procreate,
mm-hmm.
and providing, therefore, pretty much all food for humans,
yeah.
Was considered, you know, the divine feminine. And then you got the patriarchal sky gods, which kind of took over, and the female qualities got relegated to the moon.
Yeah.
At that point. It was an easy connection to make because obviously the moon waxes and wanes over a 28-day period, and most women have a menstruation cycle of around 29.5 days or slightly less.
Yeah.
So that was an easy connection. And then there's also the idea of pregnancy, where women become gradually more gravid in the same way when they're pregnant, that is.
Yeah.
Just randomly. when just in the same way that the moon, again, waxes towards the full.
Yeah.
So the moon became very connected with fertility in that respect and women's mysteries. And then over the fullness of time, obviously, that all got associated with witchcraft and women's mysteries and something that men couldn't touch and therefore was highly suspect.
That's always the thing. If men can't touch it, it's suspicious.
yeah, there's lots and lots of moon goddesses. There are a few moon gods as well, mm-hmm. but very definitely moon goddesses. One I particularly want to talk about is the Welsh goddess Arianrhod. I think this is a really interesting story, and I think it really illustrates the point of how things changed from women being very, very strong political and social leaders
mm-hmm.
to being relegated to a back burner as men kind of pushed them into the background and tried to control this ability to produce the next leaders, as it were.
Yeah.
We've talked before about, obviously, Arthurian myth.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked before how the idea of the incest in Arthurian myth actually has its basis in fact, whereby among the Celtic and Brittany-type tribes, then, you know, you could only really be sure of a bloodline through the mother. Therefore, it wasn't a man's son who inherited, it was his sister's son.
Yeah.
So it was his nephew, not his own son, who would. So the only way to be sure your son was going to do it was if you fathered a child on your sister.
Oh, where have we heard this before?
Exactly. And then part of that is there was even a phase whereby, in order to keep bloodlines pure, it was expected a woman might reasonably expect to marry her brother.
Mm.
For this very purpose. I mean, we're getting a bit Game of Thrones here, but that is very definitely there.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell you about the myth of Arianrhod. She is known as the Lady of the Silver Wheel. She's the goddess of witchcraft, enchantment, the sea as well, and the moon, very definitely, and, you know, support of women in childbirth, etc. The interesting story is she is the half-sister or the full-sister, depending on the source, of the magician Gwydion, or Gwydion.
Mm-hmm.
And she is known as a virgin goddess, but in the old style, where a virgin meant a woman who is complete in herself. So she wasn't married, and from the many tales about her, she really enjoyed getting her freak on. Definitely.
Right.
She particularly liked mermen.
Okay.
The sea people living around Wales. She especially liked them, had quite a predilection for them. So she wasn't virgin in the sense of someone who's never had sex. She was just kind of like, I don't need to be married. I have status in my own right. I require no man's protection, which is the original meaning of the word virgin or maiden.
Yeah.
Anyway, Arianrhod was one of the children, the first children of Don, or Don.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point really getting too much into that because there's not a lot of source material on Don, but Don may have been male or female or both. It's quite possible that that particular deity was in fact both at the same time.
Yeah.
Had both husbands and wives, etc.
Okay.
So, moving aside from that, Arianrhod was, you know, that high status that she would be, her child would inherit the power and the next great, and, you know, the crown, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
This did not suit Gwydion very much. Gwydion would have quite liked to be able to father the next heir, and he devised a plan. Now, Gwydion was a great sorcerer, but Arianrhod was a great sorceress, mm-hmm. so the only way in order to get what he wanted was to trick her.
Right.
He, at the time, their uncle, King Math, yeah, he was living under a guise, which meant that when he was not in battle, the only way he could sleep was to rest his feet in the lap of a virgin.
Right.
There's a really dark tale there as well, but we won't go into that. Anyway, there was an opening for the job position, and Gwydion suggested his sister Arianrhod. And Math was kind of like, yeah, okay, that sounds reasonable, fine. She's a high-status maiden kind of thing. Gwydion went off to make the proposal to Arianrhod, but instead of... He made two suggestions. One was that she take this mm-hmm. job, being basically King Math's foot warmer, guardian of his feet while he slept. And the other was that she marry him. And Arianrhod was kind of like, I don't need to marry anybody. Look at all this stuff I've got. I don't need a man, and I don't really want to marry you anyway. You're my brother. But it seems that they may have had sex. And then Arianrhod, who would have quite liked some of Math's power anyway, well, we don't like some Math's power, kind of went for the job anyway. Math said, in order to know that you are a true virgin, I need you to step over this rod. And he laid a rod on the ground. Arianrhod stepped over it and immediately gave birth to young Dwyer. Dwyer became one of the gods of the sea. Basically, this baby apparently just crawled off and immediately jumped into the sea. You remember her predilection for mermen, so it's kind of like, yeah, okay, that's possible. And the afterbirth was taken by Gwydion, and Gwydion created a child from the afterbirth who was his sister's heir, which is why Arianrhod, who was really, really fucking pissed off that she'd been made to give birth without her consent, cursed the child with three curses, which is where you get the Tengedda of Arianrhod. And obviously that child became Clutha Griffiths, who was married to Blodeveth. This is the fourth branch of the Mabinogi, yeah. I think. Anyway, the point of that that's really interesting is that this is Arianrhod's bit of the tale, and this is a very clear indication of a woman, a moon mm-hmm. goddess, who has been forced to have children by a male god, male yeah. character. And it is very representative of that sort of, you know, I mean, it was a Welsh mother's right. They weren't really Welsh at the time. A Cymry mother's right to deny her son the right to bear arms or mm-hmm. a name, so she could have a child and disinherit him, which is essentially what it yeah. was. You're nothing, you're nobody, and therefore you will never have these three yeah. things. And imagine that amount of political power, and then, again, being gradually tricked out of these things. So while it seems like she's being very harsh in that particular myth, this is actually kind of like, no, you have forced me to have children. I mean, in some versions of the myth, Gwydion actually rapes his sister. In others, which clearly have come later, she has seduced her brother. So, again, what does that reflect? Yes. So it's this idea of this very political and politically strong female character who is gradually having it all stripped away yeah. from her. And you find that a lot of the moon goddess myths tend to reflect very similar themes.
Oh, dearie me. So, I mean, it's quite interesting because there is also this connection between the moon goddess and this idea of virginity. So in terms of whether we mean the olden tale of never being married or having any sort of connection or never having sex. Because obviously that's also reflected in some of the other moon goddesses, such as Artemis.
Yes, Artemis is an interesting one because the suggestion is that she did not have sex with a man, but she was quite profligate with yeah. women.
Which is fine.
With the Romans, really, kind of capitalized on that with their version of mm-hmm. Diana, who was supposed to be a chaste huntress yeah. goddess.
And that is also the other thing to remember, is that the Greek gods, there are two types. There are the actual Greek gods, and then there are the Roman gods. But also with the Greek gods, they too have gone through several stages. I mean, you just have to look at Dionysus and how he has evolved from probably being one of the key gods in the very, very early Greek civilization to being this suddenly this god of wine. I mean, there's evidence that he might even have been one of the gods of the underworld of life and death much, much earlier on. So obviously there's going to be lots and lots of changes over time as society changes and the gods change to reflect that.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously it's not just Celtic mythology or Greek mm-hmm. mythology. Pre-Roman and pre-Greek, Diana was actually the goddess of enchantment and the mm-hmm. moon. And the goddess of women, and it sounds a bit weird to have a goddess of women, but mm-hmm. there you are. And all women were supposed to sort of be made in her image. So that's a pre-Greek idea. The Romans kind of stole the name and then very much limited everything because she was the goddess of the moon and the sun and yeah. the stars. So kind of everything.
Yeah.
But she's sort of newly worshipped now by most Wiccan mm-hmm. traditions as the triple goddess.
Yeah. And you can understand why, really. But again, there's just this real connection with the moon there, particularly. And this is the other thing, is that there is a big connection with the moon and paganism and witchcraft in particular.
Yes, which we'll get onto that in yeah. a bit, because there is some interesting stuff. So other moon goddesses. I mean, there's loads and loads of them, but okay, an example of a moon mm-hmm. god, or kind of a moon god, you've got the two children, the twins, Mani and I can't remember the sun god's one. Anyway, this is Norse mm-hmm. tradition. Mani was assigned the chariot of the moon, and his brother was assigned the chariot of the sun. It might be Sol, yes. That sounds about right. Their parents offended somebody. Yeah, the gods didn't like it very much. So they were kind of like, you will chase each other across the sky for eternity. It wasn't chased. The way it was phrased was, you know, motivated by wolves, which will chase yeah. your chariot.
I think, yeah, what happened...
Until Ragnarok.
Yeah, it was a man who proclaimed that his children were more beautiful than the sun and the moon, and thus named them Sun and Moon. And apparently the Aesir were so offended by this that they're like, well, put them in the sky, and they shall literally drag the sun and the moon around, and there will be wolves chasing them. Hooray!
Yes. Until the day of Ragnarok,
yes.
So, yeah, I mean, the Norse gods are some of the nastiest gods.
They really are. They're not joking around. I mean, to be honest, the Greek gods are also not joking around most of the time.
No, definitely not. There is also the Chinese goddess Chang'e. Mm-hmm. Chang'e was banished to the moon, which sounds a little bit sort of like it's going a bit mm-hmm. sci-fi. To the moon with a rabbit for company because she stole the potion of immortality from her husband. Her husband was the archer who shot down the other 9 suns so the earth would not be burned.
Yeah, I love that story of the shooting down of the suns, because it's just they're like, they've all gone into the sky at once. So please, somebody, can you help me get my children out of the sky? And this archer's like, yeah, sure thing. And he just killed 9 of them.
Yes, and was rewarded with a potion of immortality. I mean, to be honest, he sounds like a dick, so maybe she was happier on the moon.
Yeah, maybe. But, and she had a rabbit, so, you know, all things considered.
Yes. Moving on to bathing and sleeping by moonlight. I know this sounds, again, a bit This is one where it's difficult to pinpoint exact myths and legends mm-hmm. and gods, but the idea is very strong amongst the sort of amongst the Jamaican population that if you slept in full moonlight you would become mad.
Mm.
Because the goddess would steal your wits.
Now that's an interesting idea.
And you'll find that amongst other African traditions, except in some cases it's considered desirable because it's sort of equated almost with the Greek divine madness, whereby you're giving up your ability to reason, but you become a mouthpiece for the gods.
Yeah, and there is actually, again, a link between the moon and foresight and powers, and just being able to prophesize things, isn't there?
Yeah. Again,
we'll jump into that a little bit.
But yeah, I mean, the whole sort of the idea of divination sort of comes from largely Celtic and Brythonic, but you do find it a little bit in some of the Greek and other myths as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, the idea of the moon being a scrying bowl or, you know, looking into a bowl of water by moonlight sort of comes from there. Final thing with gods, hares.
Yes.
Very specifically hares. There is a really strong tradition of connection of hares with the moon, or in some cases rabbits. Some peoples over time have used the words hare and rabbit interchangeably. Mm. They're obviously not the same at all. I think some of this is to do with the fact that the hare was considered a divine animal for divination. Mm-hmm. It's not actually native to Britain. It was introduced sort of in, we know, during the Roman conquest, mm-hmm. very, very early on. And we've got a record of Boudicca using hare entrails to divine the outcome of a battle, which is what happened before she burned Colchester to the ground.
Yeah. It is interesting that the hare is still obviously linked very much in the UK. You see it everywhere. I mean, I was just in Glastonbury fairly recently, before lockdown, I should add. And there were just hares everywhere. And what I mean by it is in, like, the hare motif, the whole of Glastonbury isn't covered with live hares, though I'm sure there are a few lurking about, but they were just sort of everywhere. The symbol was everywhere, usually associated with the moon. And then, of course, in Japanese culture, and I think across, you know, in Chinese as well, there is this idea of, rather than the man on the moon, the moon is, there's a rabbit instead.
Yes. With a pestle
water. And it's even, I mean, they even do a pun about it for Sailor Moon, for anyone who remembers Sailor Moon. The main character is called Usagi, which means rabbit, and her surname is Tsukino, which means of the moon. So her full name is... So her first name is Usagi. And her family name is Tsukino. So altogether it's Tsukino Usagi, which means the rabbit of the moon. So big tick for Japanese puns there.
I think it's interesting that some people looked at the moon and saw a concerned face and assumed it was female. And some people looked and thought, oh, it's the man in the moon peering down at us. This is all the synchronous orbits that we always see the same side. And a whole bunch of other people on the other side of the world went, it's a rabbit. It's clearly a rabbit.
It's very obviously a rabbit.
the hare connection is, you know, partly to do with Ceridwen, who transformed herself into a hare as well. There's a whole bunch of folklore about hares as well, which, again, I'll mention in a moment. But the sort of hare goddess moon connection is a really strong one, and as you say, it is a strong aspect of the triple goddess now. So the hare and the doe and the moon are all sort of, and the wolf as well, are all interconnected. In fact, I think the hare and the wolf were Arinhrod's symbols as well.
That's very interesting, particularly because the two seem, because the hare in comparison to the wolf, I mean, the hare is still quite fierce. You should see them fighting, But, you know, the hare is a prey animal. The wolf is obviously a hunter.
Well, of course, the interesting thing about hares fighting is that it's the females boxing the males to see if they're strong enough to be mates. I'm not joking. It is.
No, I know, but it's just a love animal courting rituals, because I just love to imagine them being sort of translated into human courting rituals. It's like, I'd like to date you. All right, get your gloves on. Let's see whether you're strong enough.
That seems perfectly sensible to me, but what do I know?
Anyway.
Right, so let's look at some of the folklore / superstition of things to do with the moon. The one that I think is probably most common, that most people will have heard of, is the idea of wart charming.
Right.
The idea, you know, before we had the ability to freeze off warts and things, you know, it's caused by either a little fungus or a little virus that gets under your skin and then obviously forms a wart, and they're unsightly. And you can sort of get them from milking cows and things, not cowpox, but, you know, you can get warts and things from there, or from pigs. So when we used to live much more closely with our livestock, including keeping them inside in the house with us in the winter, people did tend to get warts, and you'd get them on their hands and their faces and the backs of their necks. And it was a real problem, because they're not really harmful, but they're unsightly and people don't like them. So
yeah,
wart charming was a thriving business at one point. To the point when remedies and things handed down, and there's everything from sort of, you know, taking the juice of a dandelion and wiping it on the affected area over a period of an entire moon, to bathing by moonlight in a silver bowl, you know, from a silver bowl. Presumably they don't expect you to have a solid silver bowl that's actually big enough to bath in.
It's just solid.
Although there are a couple of medieval accounts of people doing exactly that.
That's incredible.
So yes, wart charming. Wart charming for a little while there was kind of like the other name for witchcraft. So you might not actually be charming warts, but you were kind of using the moon and the moon's powers.
Yes, that's incredible. I shall bear that in mind.
Honestly, you're better off going and getting them frozen off if it's a real issue. Anyway.
Okay, let's move on very quickly, shall we?
So, again, charms and things that involve the moon. Conception. If you are having trouble conceiving, again,
yes,
you might go and see a goody good wife who kept a little house just outside the village and gave herbs to those who needed them. And, yeah, certain charms and things to do with the moon and, you know, the waxing and waning of the moon were supposed to make it a little bit easier to conceive.
Yes. Which, again, I can kind of see the logic of, because I'm almost certain that there were some sort of beliefs that just as the tide was affected by the moon, women's bodies were affected by the moon.
Exactly. That may not entirely be completely off the wall either. Certain parts of it, you'd have to be quite careful. There's the long-standing, certainly in the UK, tradition of planting and gathering based on the phases of the moon. So a waxing moon is the best time to be planting anything where you hope to harvest it from above the soil, and the waning moon for anything that grows below soil level. That's a very, very simplified way of doing it. If you practice herbalism of any kind as well, and you're familiar with Culpeper's Herbal, then you'll find that lots of particular plants and herbs are supposed to be picked during particular moon phases for great efficacy.
Yes.
I honestly can't say whether these things make it more effective. The basis for the planting and gathering, you know, a lot of it is agricultural and being sort of tuned into the seasons. Even if it doesn't cause a direct correlation or a direct causation, I think it's worth being tuned into the natural world. I think that's something we've actually lost a lot of. So in the same way that if you happen to be part of one of the fishing families around the coast, they tend to know the tides because they have to. Their livelihood depends on it. Most of us don't have any concept of the tides. This is sort of the same with the moon phases. Most people don't really know anything. They'll Google an almanac online. It's actually worth being a bit more tuned into the natural world than that, in my opinion.
That's fair enough. I can see the point.
So I've never actually seen one, but moon bows.
Ah, yes.
So like rainbows, but in the same way that water will break up the light from the sun into various different parts of the magnetic spectrum, light from the moon can also be broken up in the same way by rain or water. Although because of the way it's refracted, it tends to appear on the opposite side of the sky to the moon.
Now that's a real shame. I've never seen that. I've heard of it, but have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
No.
As I was saying. Something to look out for.
Something to look out for, indeed.
I think part of the thing is obviously that if it's raining, then there's probably clouds in the way.
Unfortunately. Yeah. I mean, look, I think the closest I've seen is a halo around the moon, but that's obviously a little bit different from a moon bow.
Yeah, I've seen moon halos quite a few times. Some people consider them to be a warning. Some people consider them to be that's a wishing moon kind of thing. So really it depends where you are in the world.
Okay. I like that. It's like, oh, that's good luck. It's a wish. Or no, that's a warning. Which one, guys? Both.
It's something that you do tend to see in the colder part of the year in the UK, because if you've got a clear, frosty sky, there's usually a lot of moisture in it, and then you tend to then get that sort of halo effect.
Yeah.
When you get a slightly tinted pink moon, a pink moon is supposed to be a harbinger of destruction.
Oh, hooray!
They're very, very pretty, but at the same time it's kind of like, ah, blood on the moon, expect blood on the ground. There's that entire Nick Drake song called Pink Moon, and it's got this really cheerful, peppy little tune, and then you listen to the lyrics and you realise that what he's actually saying is it doesn't matter how tough or how powerful you are, ultimately your end destination is death, and the pink moon proves that.
Wow. Okay.
That's, he wasn't a happy soul, Nick Drake.
No. Deary me. Okay.
Yeah. We talked about, Madeline mentioned the blood moon. Blood moon comes from the Anglo-Saxon or Old English Blotmanath, which means blood moon, and it's the November full moon, usually, or roughly around the November full moon.
Yeah.
And it sounds really forbidding, but what it really meant was, oh, there's a full moon, this is a good time to get those last few hunts in and also to slaughter any animals that won't make it through the winter.
Yeah.
There was obviously a darker side to it as well, as we get with bonfires, whereby in some cases they might have disposed of a few people they thought were going to make it through the winter.
Yes. And that is certainly a little bit more uncomfortable. Though it really is interesting to me, because also there was the burning of things that you kind of wanted to be rid of. In that particular way, which could include effigies. So it didn't necessarily have to be people. But certainly, the blood moon representation there. We always tend to see it as quite a negative thing. And perhaps for some people it was.
Yeah. I think the thing is, autumn can be quite, for what you've got to get done in late summer, early autumn, if you're thinking in terms of agriculture and preserving for winter, and certainly back between sort of the 1400s to the late 1800s, when we were in a mini ice age and winters were very, very harsh, then you had a very, very short autumn. You had a short period of time to get all the food in. So, the harvest moon of September, October was, okay, we're still working by moonlight. to get the harvest in. And that was something that genuinely used to happen. And the same with the blood moon. It was a case of, we need to get these animals slaughtered and cut up and preserved and salted ready so that they're not going to waste and so that there's enough food for the other animals to get through the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So the moon names are quite telling. The December moon is the wolf moon, I think.
Yeah.
So again, the time when it gets cold enough for the wolves to start howling around and coming closer to human dwellings and things, which they would normally avoid in the hopes of getting hold of a, not necessarily a human, but certainly a hold of some livestock.
Yes. Which is obviously not something that we have to deal with in the modern day in Britain. That I know of.
No, I mean, we do still have wolves in national parks in Scotland, but they were reintroduced. The wolf was hunted to extinction in the sort of late 1400s over here.
Yeah.
So, but it's interesting that we should talk about wolves because it brings us to werewolves, which you say full moon and everyone's like, ah, werewolves.
Yes.
And the interesting thing is that werewolves had nothing to do with full moons. That was a conceit of Hollywood.
Yeah, that was the thing that always got me, is that in the original mythos, whenever you have any kind of creatures which resembles a werewolf, and obviously there are several versions of what a werewolf actually is, it originally didn't have very much to do with the full moon at all. The moon, yes, but not necessarily the full moon.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can understand it, because you're starting the age of film and cinema, if you like, and in the same way that vampires were not vanquished by the sun, and necessarily, depending on which mythos you went with.
Thanks, Nosferatu.
Yeah, it was introduced by that film, and people loved that sort of idea.
Yeah.
And if you want something very visual, then you've got this dark black and white film and a man turning into a wolf, and you've got the full moon in the background. And it just sort of says wildness. And also there's that part of the human psyche where we've absorbed a lot of myths and stories and things, and the full moon actually means transformation magic.
Mm. Yeah. Which, again, makes sense. A lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think the werewolf thing's interesting, and we've talked about werewolves, so I won't go on about them too much, but the idea when you connect it with the full moon, it had far more to do with witchcraft, in the sense of here's a nice jar of flying ointment and a wolfskin belt, now go and get naked in the woods under the full moon and you will see some shit if you rub that onto your skin. But I'm not surprised they did, because the stuff that went into flying ointment so if you'd seen pixies come down from the moon at that point, I would not have been surprised.
Sorry, it just makes me think of absinthe.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it would not have been a pleasant high, though, I don't think. Your skin would have felt like it was itching and burning.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a whole other episode, right
there. Don't make flying ointment, guys. I'm not going to tell you what goes into it. You don't need to know.
You seriously don't want to know.
Finally, on the folklore and superstition bit, I've got all the way through this episode without saying the word shay or fairy. But if we're going to talk about blue moons and fey moons, I might have to mention them.
Oh, well, there you go. And it wasn't me. Hooray!
So, as Madeline said, we've not long had a blue moon. A blue moon is basically the second full moon in a month. Bearing in mind the variabilities of various different calendars, it probably wasn't quite such a phenomenon centuries ago. Mm-hmm. However, the understanding is that the blue moon is the reflection of the... Okay, whenever there's a full moon, that's supposed to mean there's a dark moon in the other world. So if you get two full moons, the second one means that the other world is much closer because you've seen the dark moon, the reflected full moon, twice within one moon cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Fey moons, that's when you get two dark moons within a month. And again, it's the reflection. It means that there's in the other world, there's a full moon happening.
Yeah.
according to popular mythos.
Yes.
I'd like to say I don't actually know this for certain. Just talk as though, you know, to talk about moon rocks. Now I'm talking about, yes, and obviously in the fairy realm, this is what happened. Honestly, don't know.
That's what she's saying to cover herself, because the AC have forbidden her from speaking about the truth of what she's witnessed. I know. but yeah, it doesn't surprise me in the least that there is actually a lot of connection with, well, in at the very least, Celtic mythology with the moon as well as the Fae. And I am still very proud that I wasn't the one who brought it up. So let's talk about a few weird correlations to do with the moon. And these are based on real facts and truths, which I think provoke some of the mythos, but also just in general add to that kind of general mystery of what it is, our weird relationship with the moon. And the first one I want to mention is that why is there an increase in attendance at A&E on a full moon, Jules?
Don't know. I don't think anyone knows. The thing when you say facts here, it's a case of there are studies that show a correlation. We don't know there's a causation. And there are studies which disprove this correlation as well. And they're about equal in terms of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So this is more added for interest's sake.
Yeah.
But yeah, having worked in accident and emergency for years on the night shift, I can honestly tell you that everybody battened down the hatches when there was a full moon, because we absolutely knew that we would get three things. We would get a large number of patients who were suffering from mental illness of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Often people who were deliberately self-harming, coming in having found that they'd cut a bit too deep that night.
Right.
We'd get lots of suicide attempts, again, who brought in. We'd quite often see victims of very violent crimes.
Yeah.
And we would also have women who weren't quite due to give birth yet, and their waters would suddenly go. People have you know, sort of poo-pooed all three of those things. And I can honestly say that, yes, it's a correlation. I can't prove any of it.
And no.
No study actually can. But personally, when I think back to A&E, I think full moon night, yeah, I would expect all of those three things. And we got them every single time that I can remember working a full moon night over a period of a number of years.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why we get the word lunacy.
Yeah, I mean, they obviously did believe that it sort of had a strong connection with the moon. It's a difficult one. I did know a lot of people who worked, obviously when I was working in A&E, I knew a lot of people who worked at some of the local mental health clinics. And you could absolutely guarantee that they would also have an increase in incidence. That the one thing that they relatively have proved the correlation of is that certain types of violent schizophrenic episode do tend to happen during a full moon.
Yeah.
But it doesn't account for all of it. So I don't know. It's a bit of an unusual one. And I think part of the problem is it's also been popularized by versions of Dracula
and things. Yes. Yeah.
Another gothic sort of like, oh, we're in a mental asylum kind of thing.
Yes. I certainly think that we can blame the Victorians.
Yes. So I don't know. It's interesting because obviously the moon has a great effect on the tides, huge seas, bodies of water, and we're all about 80% water. So could it possibly have an effect on us? We don't know. We've not proved it. We have proved that it makes sap rise in certain plants, however.
Well, that is interesting.
So it might not be completely out there. The increase in violent crime and murder, that's just that's a weird one.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's not really something people have sat down and done studies over, but when people have done sort of tentative studies, they have found a slight increase. So the sort of call-outs for the police on full moon nights, again, having known an awful lot of police officers, it's like, yeah, it's a full moon night. Yeah, we're battening down the hatches. You'll find that with anything, sort of the ambulance service, hospitals, mental health institutes, the police. Everyone's kind of like, it's a full moon night. Everybody on full alert kind of thing.
Yeah. So that it's the saying. It's when the weirdos come out. But isn't there also a correlation between hair and nail growth during the waxing moon?
That's another one where they have found it works. Not mm-hmm. that it works, rather. Not that it won't make your hair grow. I think some people say you should have your hair cut during the waxing phase of the moon because it will make mm-hmm. your hair grow faster. They haven't proved that. But they have proved that it seems to grow more. So it's a bit of a... But then other people have then gone and proved that, you know, it doesn't affect it at all.
Yeah.
And I really need somebody who's, like, completely neutral on the subject to just study it, and obviously they're not going to be interested. So I think there's a lot of confirmation bias on that one, but it's possible. There are full moon sleep disturbances, and that is actually quite well documented. So you are most adults are less likely to sleep, or rather they sleep a shorter period of time in the sort of few days run up to the full moon and the full moon itself and just after. And in children, there's quite a well-known cycle of sleep disturbance around the full moon.
Hmm. Could that be because of the extra light from outside, or...?
Quite possibly. No, well, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? What it's done, again, all of these are correlations, they're not causations.
Hmm.
So what you're being told is that, okay, this happened during this time. There might be a connection, but nobody can prove it. I think the problem is a lot of these things get presented as a fait accompli, where it's like, well, obviously it must be this, rather than taking in other accounts.
Yeah, the scientist in you is lurching out, Jules.
The scientist to me is always there. It's never hidden.
Where is the data? Show me the data.
No, I'd want that. I mean, I think it's quite interesting. I won't throw away a correlation because, you know, sometimes you can find a causation. But yeah. I think you've got to be a bit careful looking for a causation exclusively, because that's when you get sort of confirmation bias.
Yeah, but I you've got to admit that regardless of what the cause is or not, you can understand where these myths and ideas come from when you have someone who awakens in the middle of the night, not even sure why. They get up, they look out, and they see this moon, this full moon, staring down at them, huge, and everything else is quiet and silent, and perhaps you can hear the bark of a fox, and that sense of isolation, of mystery, of secretiveness. It's all kind of clustered around in the darkness. You can completely understand where that mystic feeling sort of comes in, particularly also because when it came to sort of conspiratorial things, it makes sense for them to happen at night. Weirdly enough, it makes a lot more sense for them not to happen on a full moon because there's more light than
neon. Yeah, I completely agree that. I mean, the full moon was obviously good for travelling and things. I think we forget, before there was reliable electric light, the nighttime was a terrifying place for us to be.
Mm-hmm.
We're not adapted for nighttime.
No. It is. It's very interesting. And actually how the darkness can bring things up which are so easy to dismiss in the daylight. It's always my favourite things, and I'm pretty sure it's from the Other Crowd, which is a collection of stories from an Irish Seanchéad. And he speaks of collecting these stories from around Ireland. And he says that he would go to particular places, particular pubs, and he'd see people and he'd speak to them. They'd all kind of laugh at him a little bit and just be like, oh yeah, the, you know, these stories, you know, do you believe any of them, etc. And they'd all be laughing. And as the evening drew on and darkness fell, the good cheer and stuff like that would sort of hush in a little bit. And then when it was truly dark outside, they'd all be huddled at the bar. And then one by one they'd go, but I've got a story for you.
Yeah.
And it was the falling of the night suddenly made it just a little bit more possible, a little bit more believable. And yeah, I'm not surprised, therefore, that the moon has such a heavy association with the mystical side of things, when the darkness and the night naturally brings those things to the forefront of the mind.
Yeah, definitely. Right, I think we're coming towards the end of our episode, so a few bits about the moon in speculative fiction, perhaps some of our favourite moments.
Yes. So two bits that come to mind. One is a very, very small bit in Trudy Canavan's The Black Magician trilogy, where there is a moment that Sonia is looking up the moon and she's actually just killed a man for the first time. And there is this mythos which is attached within the world, which is that the sort of the full moon, if it sees you, you might go crazy, or that you might be going crazy. And it was, yeah, it was something, the idea of the moon being an eye watching you, and if it's fully open, you know, it's seeing everything that you're doing. And I remember reading that for the first time and just getting chills, and I loved that idea so much. The other one, which is the complete opposite, is from Rise of the Guardians, where you have the man on the moon, they call him, is this character who sort of presides over things the whole time. And he never speaks, but he's the one who chooses the guardians. And I liked both of these examples because there was this idea of the moon being this large influencer, this greater deity or being, which in itself couldn't sort of get down onto the earth and sort of be involved, and yet observed everything and saw everything and was kind of moving whatever pieces it could move. And I just really, really enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, cool. So for me, I really like The Little White Horse by Elizabeth Gouge.
Oh god, yes.
And I love the, she's woven this, it's not a unique mythos, but it's sort of unique to that particular world and the way she's interpreted it, the idea of the moon princess, and that the moon and the sun merryweathers, and the fact that you need both of them for balance and for, mm-hmm. for the entire Valley of Moonegg to actually be happy. And there's, you know, it's sort of layers and layers of imagery, and the moon is associated with the little white horse, which is a unicorn.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously you've got Maria Merriweather, who has to struggle with certain aspects of her character.
Yeah.
But in the end, does something very, very brave in going into the darkness, very much like the moon, in order to banish it. So mm-hmm. I love the way that's sort of layered together. And there's this beautiful bit where she finally goes off to see Monsieur Coq de Noir about, you know, giving him back the moon princess's pearls and forming a deal with him so that he will stop letting his men terrorise the neighbourhood. And she sort of goes into the dark woods and she's very, very frightened, and then something bright comes up nearby and she sees the little white horse glowing as it runs through the forest. And that's the mm-hmm. time when it turns its head and she realises that this little white horse she's been sort of seeing and dreaming about is actually a unicorn, and she's doing the right thing.
So, aww.
This lovely visual imagery. So that was one. I also really like it in Robin Jarvis's The Oaken Throne, where there is a lull in all the horrific, horrific torture and action that's going on. And the two main characters encounter this ancient, ancient hare and realise that he is actually the companion of the moon goddess, the Lady of the Moon, who is one of their gods, and sort of bestows his blessing on them.
Aww.
So that was a really nice one. Despite it being completely inaccurate, I love the visuality. Is that even a word? I love the visual nature.
It is now.
The visual nature of the full moon werewolf mythos in film.
Yeah. So absolutely.
American Werewolf, for example, or Wolf with Jack Nicholson, which is a terrible film, but I still like it, I'm afraid.
I mean, also a lot of the things with Angela Carter, too. Yeah. I mean, in The Company of Wolves, you have that visual of he opens the door and there's the full moon, and he's like, I need to go out, and then just disappears.
Yes.
Yeah, it's an incredibly strong visual, and you can understand why, with the screen, it has come into being so popular.
Definitely.
So there we have it. Our little foray into discussing the moon and all the weird and wonderful things that go along with it, including its mythos and the strange correlations that are associated with it. Do leave us a comment. Let us know what you think about this. Have you heard of any other strange correlations or facts about the moon? Or is there a piece of mythology about the moon that you particularly like that we didn't cover today? Remember, you can get in touch with us on Twitter or on Facebook, both individually or through the Dissecting Dragons page. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes, I recently completed reading a series. I say completed, I actually just tore through all five books. And that is the Eddie LaCrosse series by Alex Bledsoe. I had a moment of mental blankness there. Alex Bledsoe, who wrote the Twofer books that I've also recommended. I'm basically just reading this guy's back catalogue at this point. I think I'm going to go on to his vampire novels next because I'm just really enjoying them. Eddie LaCrosse, I would recommend for people who like Harry Dresden and also like more sort of high and epic fantasy. They're funny and gritty, and it follows the adventures of self-named sword jockey Eddie LaCrosse, who has some painful moments in his past and is basically just making his way selling his sword. So again, little bit sort of King's Knight there as well.
Oh, okay.
And it's really, really good. He goes on. The thing with Alex Bledsoe is he won't shy away from using slurs and things, but I don't think he ever uses them in a way that are disrespectful. But if you're someone who doesn't like to see them at all in a book, then they might not be for you. On the other hand, if you're kind of like, yeah, I'm okay with them being used in context and, you know, kind of called out on the page, then yeah, you'll probably get on with them fine. And it's entirely up to you. But
excellent.
Great character. Really, really, really grumpy. Fed up pretty much 90% of the time. It's kind of like, oh, great, so now I'm stuck with this. So, yeah, there's a little bit of Witcher in there as well. Basically, if you're looking for something to scratch those particular itches, definitely try this series. It's so good.
Fantastic. You've definitely sparked my interest there. All the things I like. All right, guys. Thanks very much for listening. Stay safe, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.